Some years ago, whilst I was at theological college, a group of eminent theologians brought out a book called The Myth of God Incarnate. And the main tenet of the book was that to speak of the incarnation, God taking on human flesh, was to use the language of myth. It was effectively a rejection of the divinity of Jesus Christ. And for a time, it was all the rage, as these books tend to be. The media loved it, rushed in to say that this heralded the end of the Church of England, indeed perhaps the end of the whole Christian faith. Now the interesting thing is that probably many of us here have never even heard of the book, because it was one of those books that shines very brightly for a time and then is heard of no more. And the reason for that, I think, is this, that despite all the fuss, it didn't have anything new to say. It had all been said before. It was simply a replaying, a rehash of an old heresy that said that Christ was never really God, he was just a special man. And we find this right at the very beginning of Christian history, and it has been there in one guise or another ever since. And it just resurfaced with this book. It's resurfaced a few times since, and no doubt it will go on doing so. But I remember talking to a friend of mine whose father had been a contributor to the book. And I remember reading the chapters that he wrote, and he claimed that this was the way forward. This was the hope for the Christian church. If only we would not believe this foolish myth about Christ being God, he argued, then we could get on with the real business of Christianity, whatever that might be. And I asked this friend about his father, and he said a very interesting thing. He said, it's very sad watching somebody lose their faith. Because this son wasn't a Christian himself, but he knew that beneath all the hype and the words, what he was seeing was his father losing his faith. And he recognized that unless we believe in the incarnation, that God was taking on human flesh in Jesus Christ, we will have no Christian faith. It falls apart without it. And once this man had ditched that belief, it was obvious, at least to his son, that he lost faith in any meaningful sense. And he was right. A few years later, I remember reading in the newspapers that his father had resigned holy orders, left Christian ministry altogether, and was now admitting to being an atheist. Then that's what happens. Now what we believe is that Jesus Christ was fully man and fully God. And both those two truths are equally important. And we saw last week that there's always a tendency to lose one or the other. Now there is a group of people, like this friend of mine's father, who don't believe that Christ was God. In the early church, such groups were known as adoptionists, and later there were the group called the Arians. And there are many people today in theological circles and outside who fall into the adoptionist trap. They say that Christ was a great man, that he was fully human, but that he wasn't God. And it would be ridiculous to try and claim that he was. But of course, if Christ was not fully God, he could not save us. There would be no real possibility of redemption. All he could do would be set some sort of example to us. But on the other side are the group called the Docetists. They believe that Christ was divine, that he was fully divine, but they never really believed that he was fully human. After all, he couldn't really have suffered and couldn't have died, because God cannot die, they argued. And he was a God, therefore, who just seemed to take on human form. And it's this heresy that is of particular interest this week, because our subject is how the incarnation makes sense of our humanity. And what I mean by that is this: how does the fact that God became man in Jesus Christ make sense of the experiences that we face as human beings? Take two examples. Take the example of temptation. Now, we all face temptation. At least I imagine we do. And at times, it seems almost overwhelming. We think we simply can't cope. We can't withstand it. We know what we ought to do, but we feel we just can't do it. Now, maybe the area of language or temper or our sexuality. It may be use of time. It may be laziness. It could be anything. But we all face temptations every day. And there are times when we seem powerless to do anything about it. And we begin to think that life is unfair. How can God expect me to resist temptation when he knows that I can't? And we begin to despair of the Christian life. Temptation is one area. Suffering is another. Maybe we have been through the mill. Maybe we're going through it at the moment. And we think, how can God put me through this? You know, what is he trying to prove? Haven't I suffered enough? Or we look at other people, maybe. There are some people who always seem to attract more than their fair share of suffering, aren't there? There's always something, it seems, going wrong in their lives. And we think, why does God allow this? What on earth is he playing at? And we begin in our hearts to echo the words of the old French monk who once said, God, I'm not surprised you have so few friends when you treat the ones you do have so badly. And sometimes we think like that, don't we? Sometimes that is our feeling. Now, does the incarnation therefore have anything to say to this? Well, I believe that it does. Here's some words from Dorothy L. Sayers. If Christ was only man, then he is entirely irrelevant to any thought about God. If he's only God, then he is entirely irrelevant to any experience of human life. What she's saying is this. If Christ was only a man, then he would have nothing to tell us about God. He couldn't bring us back to God. He couldn't speak for God because he'd simply be one of us. But if, on the other hand, he was only God, then he would have nothing to say about our human experience because he'd never been there. And we could justifiably say he doesn't know what it's like to be a human being. So take an example from the world of teaching. Now, in teaching, there are good teachers and bad teachers. And it's often not the cleverest people who make the best teachers, because they can't understand what it's like for the rest of us to be a bit thick. They can't quite sympathize with us, and they often have little patience with the slower ones in class. They just get frustrated when pupils don't understand. Just because somebody's brilliantly clever doesn't necessarily make them a great teacher. And we can easily have that view of God, that God doesn't understand what it's like to be me. He doesn't know what it is. If he only knew how impossible it was for me to resist that temptation, he'd never ask me to do it. Or equally, if he really knew what it was like for me to suffer, he'd never ask me to go through this suffering, unless he's some sort of cosmic sadist, I suppose. Now, when we fall into that thinking, it's just actually a form of deceitism. We are really saying that Christ never became fully human. He never really shared our human experience. He was too detached, too apart from us. And I believe the incarnation shows us something very different. So just two things I want to say this morning. First of all, I want us to note the reality of Christ's humanity. Verse 14 of chapter 2. Since the children have flesh and blood, he too shared in their humanity. Then verse 17. For this reason, he had to be made like his brothers in every way. Now, what the writer is saying is here is that Jesus' humanity was real. It wasn't a charade or a fiction. Now, it is a deep mystery if we try and understand all that that means, but we must take this very seriously because we're often beset by a form of deceitism which makes Christ's human nature rather different from ours. We see it as being just a divine life in a human shell, and just the outward shell, that was all. And we shrink from admitting that he went through human growth. There were times, maybe things he didn't know, that he faced human struggle and temptation. And it's found in many representations that we'll see of Christ. I guess many of us saw the television film Jesus of Nazareth, which was a remarkable production, wasn't it? But there were those frequent pictures of Jesus, weren't there, sort of staring away into the distance in a kind of sort of faraway mode. And it was as though he wasn't really quite human at all. He was just a little bit disengaged, detached. He wasn't quite like one of us. Now, I know, of course, it's immensely difficult to portray Jesus at all, but there is always that temptation to see him as not being fully human. And I want to say that his human experience was just like ours. So he had first an experience of the physical body. He had to be made like his brothers in every way. He was just like us. We sometimes feel that Christ wasn't subject to the frailties of being human, the weaknesses of the body. But he was like us in every way. He submitted to what it means to be human. He didn't just take on a human shell and go through the motions. No, he was fully human. So he was born as a little tiny baby. And one of the things that first struck me is I looked at our little girl in the summer and I saw at first hand the amazing miracle of life. The Lord Jesus Christ was once just like little Bethan. It's an amazing thought, isn't it? He knew the different stages of growing up. We're told that he grew in stature and wisdom. He was a teenager. He became an adult. He had a normal body with normal bodily functions. He knew what it was to be tired, to be hungry, to be thirsty. He probably got the flu. He maybe had a few doses of Bethlehem belly. He knew what it was like to feel that he wasn't well enough to go to work in the morning and things like that. He knew absolutely what it was to have the experience of a physical body. He was human in that sense. He had the experience also of suffering. Verse 18, because he himself suffered when he was tempted. It's speaking particularly here about the area of temptation, but Jesus knew suffering. He didn't only go hungry and tired, he knew pain. He knew emotional and physical pain. He knew what it was to be alone. Do you remember that occasion in John 6 when the people were beginning to drift away from him? They found it too costly to follow him. And Jesus turned to his disciples and said, are you going as well? Are you going to leave me as well? In the Garden of Gethsemane, his hour of greatest need, no one could watch with him. On the cross, all deserted him. Oh yes, loneliness was something he knew all about. There was the physical pain of the cross, the most horrific form of execution then known. He knew an intensity of suffering that most of us can only imagine and guess at. He knew that. But he knew also, as we've intimated already, the experience of temptation. 4 verse 15. We have one who has been tempted in every way, just as we are. We read in the first reading from Luke 4 about the temptations that Jesus faced for 40 days. Again, there was an intensity there in that temptation that we probably can't really imagine. And yet it is one of the things we find hard, don't we? Did Christ really know what it was to be tempted? Did he really know the power of temptation? Can he really understand what I go through in the temptations that I face? Well, I often think of an analogy. Take the analogy of torture, which I pray that none of us will ever have to undergo. Take two people who are undergoing torture. One person gives in at the first sign of it. He can't continue and gives the torturer all the information he might want. Another withstands it right to the very end, and whatever they throw at him, still he holds firm. Now tell us, which of those two knows more about torture? The answer is the one who survived to the end, the one who never gives in. That is the one who knows more about it. Now, do you see the point, therefore, about Christ? Christ never gave in to temptation, although the devil threw everything at him. So isn't it true, therefore, that he knows more about it than we ever will? That he understands temptation far better than we do? The point is that Christ knows everything about what it is to be human. He knows far better than we do what it means. He's plumbed the depths. He's been there. His humanity was no sham, no outward facade. He knew absolutely what it was to be one of us, and yet without sin. The reality of his humanity. And then notice, second, the significance of his humanity. What does this therefore tell us? Well, first, what it says is that he can set an example to us. See, Christ shows us what it is to be truly human. Here is the most fascinating, the most perfect, the most beautiful character in all history. And when we see him, therefore, we realize what being human is meant to be. I think it's John Stott who said, there is nothing more humanizing than the gospel. In other words, there's nothing that makes us more really what we were always meant to be. That's very important, because today there is a tendency to feel that somehow goodness is undesirable. It's a line that often gets peddled in the press and the media. So you see the obituaries of famous people written up in the newspapers. And they talk about people being larger-than-life characters, living life to the full and so on. And we know that's a shorthand for being something of a rogue. That's the way they write. But what they're saying is this is exciting and goodness is somehow boring. We don't really want to be good. But equally, goodness is seen as impossible. They say nobody can live like that today. Come on, be real. We're only being human. That's what people say. And there's an obvious example in the area of sexual morality. Sex outside marriage, living together outside marriage, everyday normalities. And to dare question that sort of morality today is very, very hard, isn't it? There are many other areas of morality where to hold to Christian standards is not easy. Now the point is that people regard Christian morality, Christian goodness, as both undesirable and impossible. And if somebody points out that this is less than the best, then you're told, oh, why do you Christians always go on about sin? Why don't you loosen up? After all, we're only human. It's just normal. Why do you have such a low view of human nature? We're often told that. And yet, surely, they've got it completely the wrong way around. It is only because as human beings, as Christians rather, we have such a high view of human nature that we go on about sin. Because we want to say it is possible to live a better life. We don't have to settle for a society where theft, where false accounting, where adultery, where lying are seen as normal and human, because they are not. In God's eyes, in a sense, they are subhuman, because we were made for something better. And the one who claims that what we see in today's society is normal, it's just a part of being human, then that person is the one with the low view of human nature. It's in a sense ultimately patronizing, isn't it? It's saying that we're not capable of anything better. And what Christ shows us is what we were meant to be. What it is to be truly human. As we become more like Christ, we don't become weirder or more detached. We become more human, more what we were meant to be. See, he sets us an example in showing what humanity was meant to be about in the first place. But second, he represents us. Chapter 2, verse 17. He had to be made like his brothers in every way, in order that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in service to God, and that he might make atonement for the sins of the people. Now, this is a central theme in the letter to the Hebrews. The priest was the representative of the people. He offered sacrifices on their behalf to God for the forgiveness of sins. And Hebrews says that Christ is the great high priest, the one who offers that one sacrifice once for all, never to be repeated. And he can only do that, Hebrews says, if he is one of the people himself. Christ could never represent us if he was not one of us. He could never pay the price for your sin and my sin if he hadn't first stood in our place. The point, therefore, is that without Christ's full humanity, there would be no redemption. We wouldn't be here today meeting. The whole Christian faith depends upon it. It's only as he takes on full humanity that he is able to represent us before God. He sets an example, he represents us, and third, he sympathizes with us. Chapter 4, verse 15. We do not have a high priest who's unable to sympathize with our weaknesses. We have one who has been tempted in every way just as we are, yet was without sin. What the incarnation tells us is that we don't have a distant, detached God, one who doesn't care. We have one who shares every area of our human experience, who suffers, is tempted, and who knows what it is like. It's the ultimate answer, you see, to temptation. Christ has actually been there. He knows what it's like, yet without sin. So he can offer grace and strength. You see, I don't know what you're wrestling with at the moment. Most of us as Christians are wrestling with things all the time in our lives, with temptation. And we can easily feel he doesn't understand, he doesn't know what it's like. But it's a wonderful thing that he does know. He is able to sympathize with every area of weakness because he's been there. It's the answer to suffering, isn't it? How could we listen to a God who seems oblivious to suffering? If you read any of the great Greek tragedies, the picture there that emerges of the gods is of a capricious, amoral, detached group of people who are playing out their own games at the expense of us mortals. In other creeds, you'll find that suffering is maybe an illusion, or maybe it's the result of the unchangeable law of karma. But only in Christianity, only in Jesus Christ, do you find a God who suffers with us. I was talking with a friend the other day, one who's known much sadness in his own life, and he said that he could never worship a God who'd not suffered alongside with him. And he quoted the words of that wonderful poem of Edward Shillitoe, Jesus of the Scars, which shows how different Christ is to all the other religious leaders the world has ever known. The last verse of that poem goes like this: the other gods were strong, but thou wast weak. They rode, but thou didst stumble to a throne. But to our wounds, only God's wounds can speak. And not a God has wounds, but thou alone. Only Christ has those scars, those wounds. Only Christ can sympathize with us. That is the significance of the humanity with Jesus. He sets us an example. He shows us what it means to be human. He shows us what it means to live to his standards, what it can be like. He represents us before God. He stands in our place. That's why we're here together today, simply because he was able to represent us. But he sympathizes with us. He knows exactly what our human experience is like. So where does that leave us? Well, let's close with that wonderful verse 16 at the end of chapter 4. If we turn over the page. Let us then, therefore, in the light of all this, let us approach the throne of grace with confidence, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. Let us come to him. Whatever situation we're in, let us come to him first to find mercy, because he is uniquely equipped to stand for us. Only he can bring mercy, because only he stood in our place and represented us. Now, we may not be Christian believers this morning, and we think, how can I ever come to God? How can I ever find him? And here is the answer. We don't find God. He finds us. He reaches out to us in Christ. By becoming fully one of us, like us in every way, he can represent us before God in heaven. We're told that he comes to destroy death, to make atonement, to make us at one with God. And only a God who comes to our level can do that. If Christ did not share our full humanity, he could not represent us before God. But equally, as we come to him, we will find grace. We may receive mercy and grace to help us in our time of need, suffering and temptation. I don't know what it is that we're facing today. Some particular trial, maybe. It makes us feel that we can't go on, it's too hard. Well, if that is true for us, the book of Hebrews was written just for people like us. People who are beginning to feel they had enough, they wanted to throw in the towel, they had enough of this Christianity business, they just wanted to drift away, it was too hard. It may be suffering that we're going through, we're wondering when it's going to end. We say we can't keep going, we've had too much, we've gone too far. Or it may be temptation. It may be that we've tried to resist, we've tried to stay pure, but we can't carry on. And yet here is the promise that we need to hold on to. That in him we will find grace. We will find strength to help us in our time of need. Will we come to him and hold on to him? He became just like us. He became fully human. Makes sense of our humanity, doesn't it? It shows us what it means to be human. He deals with our sin and he comes alongside us. So let's today come to him. And when we share in a moment or two in the bread and the wine, maybe we can use that just to come back to him, to draw near with confidence, to find his grace and his mercy. Shall we, as we close, pray together? Let us then approach the throne of grace with confidence, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. Lord Jesus, we thank you for this incredible picture that you became one of us, that you know absolutely what our human experience is. And I pray that whatever situation we are in today, each one of us might come to you to find the grace and the mercy we need. And we ask it for your name's sake. Amen.